Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. It was a Nixon-esque moment. A politician asked about questionable campaign tactics when Michael Grieco told the Miami Herald to, quote, look right into my soul. That was back in June when he was a Miami Beach City Commissioner with his eyes on the mayor's office. He was denying any involvement in a political action committee for which public records showed he had filled out the paperwork. By July, he had quit the race for mayor, and then last month, he quit his commission reelection campaign. And this week, the fall was complete. He resigned his commission seat and pleaded no contest to a criminal charge of taking an illegal campaign contribution. Grieco spoke with Local 10 after entering his plea.
I'm happy to put this behind me, looking forward to the next chapter. So is my family.
That next chapter may well include public office again. He didn't admit any guilt, and he can run for office in 1 year. Local politics is where we begin the Florida Roundup this week. The fall from grace for a rising political star in Miami Beach. How did it happen? Are you a constituent of Grieco's? Would you support him if he runs and returns to the political stage in the years ahead? And how does the intersection of money and politics influence local elections? This is where we begin this week on the Roundup. Join us, won't you, at 800-743-WLRN. Our phone number across South Florida, toll-free, 800-743-9576. You can also join us on social media, on Facebook and Twitter. Look for our handle at WLRN. Joy Fletcher covers the city of Miami Beach for our partner, the Miami Herald. Nick Nehemas is an investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. Both of them have been on this story, broke this story back in the summertime, and have continued on through it this week as well. Nick, let's begin here. What charges did the now former commissioner face this week?
Grieco faced a rather narrow charge of knowingly accepting a campaign contribution made in the name of another person.
And what was it that made that contribution illegal?
It was made in the name of a luxury real estate broker in Miami by the name of Tony Rodriguez Tejaheche, but it was not his money. The funds actually came from a Norwegian millionaire, a friend. Both men are friends of former Commissioner Grieco, and he gave the money to Tejaheche, and then the money was given to the political action committee that was helping Grieco run for mayor.
Is the portion of it that made it against the law the fact that it was money from someone who's not an American citizen?
That is against the law, but that was not what they charged him with. That would be a federal violation. They charged him with the violation of Florida's campaign finance laws. It simply says that if you give money to a political candidate or committee, it has to be your money.
So how do prosecutors think that this worked? What was the flow of dollars?
It started with Pater wanting to help his friend Michael Grieco, and Grieco asking for a contribution, $25,000, very specifically to help his run for mayor, with an understanding that Pater couldn't give the money directly. Now, you know, there could be a way if the money had been earned in the U.S. and was donated through a U.S. company, even if it's a subsidiary of a foreign corporation or a foreign person. That would be legal, but that's not what happened. The money was given to Tony, and then Tony gave the money in his own name.
Joy Fletcher, describe kind of the scale of this saga from June when you and Nick first began reporting on the commissioner, the then commissioner and mayoral candidate's involvement with his political action committee, to this week with the no contest plea.
Well, there had been rumors that Michael Grieco had been active with a political committee that was raising money from city vendors, lobbyists, and real estate developers. And that alone in the city of Miami Beach is an issue for voters. Mm-hmm. They're very sensitive to where money comes from and how it influences politics in the municipal arena. So we started looking into it because we got tips, and tips were going around to a lot of different media outlets and a lot of different folks about where this money was coming from and how it was tied to people who do business with the city. And that's where we started, asking questions about what relationship this money had with people that have business before the city. And then it took a turn when the state attorney got involved and started investigating.
And that political contribution from vendor has been highlighted by the commission itself in the last cycle in 2013, maybe two cycles ago, became a significant issue, and the commission had tried to take some steps to change that.
Right. A couple of years ago, there was another separate controversy involving Mayor Philip Levine and former Commissioner Jonah Wolfson, and a PAC that they had their names on, at least, and then had public association with. But they were raising money from folks who did business with the city, and that was legal at the time. The city moved, including Michael Grieco, voted to create an ethics ordinance locally that would prevent sitting elected officials from soliciting these kinds of contributions for a PAC. And that was the basis for some of our early reporting on this, whether or not there had been a violation to that effect.
Describe Grieco's governing style.
Grieco is known in Miami Beach for being a pothole commissioner.
Would describe what that means.
Are there
a lot of potholes in Miami Beach? Not in my experience.
Not in my experience either. But basically, if something was going on in your neighborhood, if that street light at your corner was flickering, and you really wanted somebody to respond to you at 2 in the morning when you noticed it, Michael Grieco is known for being the guy that you texted.
Yeah.
And he would respond. And there's a lot of people on the island who would tell you that.
We're talking about the fall from political office and higher aspirations, at least during this election cycle, of now former Miami Beach Commissioner Michael Grieco. We're speaking with the two reporters that have covered the story from the get-go. Joy Fletcher is covering the Miami Beach City Hall for the Miami Herald, and Nick Nehamas, investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. Join us on the telephone at 800-743-9576. Even if you don't live on the beach, what about this kind of political contribution controversy? 800-743-WLRN. Joy, the political base that former Commissioner Grieco was trying to build upon, describe that for us.
Well, his political career in the beach started in the south of Fifth neighborhood, down in South Beach, where you see all those high condos,
yep.
And there's a lot of money, and there's a lot of people who are politically active and very engaged. And he built himself up from the local neighborhood association to the commission 4 years ago. And he used that as a springboard while he was a commissioner to reach out to other parts of the city, North Beach, Middle Beach. He was known for going to every single homeowners association, condo association meeting, and he had fans and he had backers across the island. His base were people who cared about very bread and butter local neighborhood issues, getting your trash picked up on mm-hmm. time, feeling safe, public safety. As opposed to some other folks in the commission who maybe have like the bigger, you think of the mayor, you think of Silver Rise and kind
right.
of big issues. He was very parochial. He was very much like, let's take care of what's inside our borders. Let's create a park ranger program. He was, people really liked that. And he was a big spearheader.
Parochial,
of that.
But ambitious too, politically
Correct.
Ambitious.
Absolutely. Yeah. He did want to be the mayor and he wanted to explode, his style of government into, infect the rest of the commission with it really.
Yeah.
So, and he was certainly known for being out there on social media and in the press as much as he could. And it's very comparable to, say, someone like Levine who does the same thing for different issues.
Philip Levine, the current mayor of the city.
Correct, yeah. Yes. He was the guy who was all over your Facebook responding to your complaint about what something you saw in your neighborhood
mm-hmm.
before you even had a chance to reach out to him. I mean, that's the kind of guy he
Populist,
was
but push back as well, Nick. Push back. Even on Facebook or on Hurricane Irma, there was some controversy about was he really in Miami Beach? While his posts seem to suggest that, turns out that he wasn't.
Right, yeah. I mean, he was a very aggressive figure, on the commission when he was a prosecutor with the media. He, as he told us himself, he's not a wallflower. He speaks his mind, and in his own words, that makes him a target.
And among the words that he delivered to you, Nick, and to Joy, was now the words that are going to go down in the record book here in South Florida when it comes to politicians and behavior. Look right into my soul. Describe that moment, Nick and Joy. What was that? Where did it happen? And how did he deliver that? And frankly, what were you thinking when you heard that?
Well, we were having a conversation at his law office in downtown, and we were there with him and his political consultant. We were having an on-the-record interview, a wide-ranging conversation, although it would have been more wide-ranging if he had told us he was involved with the PAC. But he was saying he wasn't.
Right, and, the Political Action Committee. You were trying to get some more details.
We were
there.
Trying to get yeah. more details, and we posed the question in several different ways. This is your friend, his friend chairs the committee. This is your friend. Are you involved? And at one of those instances, I think Nick posed the question very directly, like, tell us, yes or no, are you involved? And he responded with, you can look right into my soul.
That, as a reporter, that was a real aha moment because, you know, not only was his friend the chairman of the group, not only had people donated to Michael Grieco's campaign at the same time as they donated to this mysterious committee, but donors had told us that Grieco himself had asked them for money specifically to support his mayoral campaign. And, you know, this was something of a confrontational interview because, mm-hmm. you know, it was two sides. You know, we were presenting this very hard evidence and we were getting pushback in the strongest terms. So, you know, when Grieco put it in terms of his soul, it really made me question why he was denying this so strongly when, you know, what we were talking about was a city ethics ordinance and, you know, maybe a mea culpa to voters. It really made us question what else is going on here that we haven't discovered. And that's when we really started pursuing the handwriting story, right. Which showed that he himself had filled out documents, a document for the PAC.
And then as you write in your most recent reporting, his soul could not be reached for comment.
That is correct.
We tried, but no luck.
No luck. Talking with Nick Nehamas, investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. Joy Fletcher's covers City Hall on Miami Beach for our partner, the Miami Herald, as well. Talking about the fall of now former Miami Beach Commissioner Michael Grieco this week, pleading no contest to state charges of accepting any legal finance, illegal contribution to a political campaign. 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Charlie has been holding on line one. Charlie, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I live in North Beach. I'm pleased at the outcome of this investigation against Michael Grieco. My question has to do with, you mentioned the past political action committee that Mayor Levine and Jonah Wolfson had to shut down. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know, you know, what's going on with the current political action committee that Philip Levine has. It's called All About Florida. And I'd like to know especially about the mayor's connections to the Blavatnik brothers. And a gentleman named Sandor Scher. They are trying to develop the Ocean Terrace.
Yeah.
And also in connection to the North Beach ballot question.
Sure.
Which I think, you know, we already voted that down once.
The North Beach ballot question, Charlie, hold on here, refers to a question on the November ballot for beach voters that will essentially allow kind of expanded or more dense development. Yeah, more dense development here. Let's tackle, there's a lot there on the table, Charlie. Let's tackle the Political Action Committee first of Mayor Levine. Joy, what can you tell us about what you know?
He has raised a significant amount of money from a lot of interests, and he is expected to make an announcement regarding what could be a run for governor next week. All year, though, he's been sort of soft campaigning, right? Mm-hmm. And he's been raising money. And so we're starting to look into a committee that he has and where that money is coming from. There are large chunks. In a municipal arena, he was self-funding the vast majority of his campaign, but he's not going to do that for a state.
Does a political action committee, are the rules different if it's a PAC that is to benefit a municipal candidate, in other words, a candidate for a relatively small population city like Miami Beach, or that exists for future political ambitions that as yet are unarticulated?
There are a lot fewer rules when you start exploding it out into the state state races and even federal races. When it comes to PACs, there is political free speech. And that's actually something, a point that Grieco made to us in our conversations, which was that he actually felt like this whole thing might have somewhat of a chilling effect on political free speech. But as our caller pointed out, I mean, there's a sensitivity to this thing, particularly in Miami Beach. And so, yeah, I mean, people want to know, even if Levine runs for governor, they want to know where his PAC money's coming from.
Yeah,
so it's something we look into.
What's fueling that sensitivity, particularly on the beach? Charlie, the caller, mentioned a couple of different sources of folks who are part-time residents. I believe at least the brothers are extremely wealthy, ultra net worth wealth. That certainly is up and down the beach. Is that the source of this curiosity, do you think, Nick?
Yeah, well, the beach is a town of what, 80,000 people?
Yeah.
90,000.
42,000 voters, I think.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, but it's not your typical small town. It has these extremely powerful moneyed interests, real estate developers, hotels, nightclubs, restaurants, and they, you know, are willing to throw a lot of money into these elections that otherwise wouldn't merit as much consternation. And so voters are very worried about where this money is coming from, who in their minds is winning the allegiance of the politicians representing them. And it really does make for interesting political races.
It's a city that punches above its weight class in many, many different ways. Let's go to Homestead, where Stephen is with us. Stephen, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi. I know Michael Greco as a South Florida Politico person myself, political person. Greco's a good guy. He gives a damn about the community. But he let the ambition get a hold of him too much, and you just can't be not forthright when it comes to campaign finance. We need to strengthen our campaign finance laws.
Great.
Thank you.
Stephen, thanks so much for your thoughts here. Let's go to Miami. Chris, you are on the radio. Thanks for holding on. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I was wondering if it isn't the donor.
Chris, the phone's breaking up here, but I think I got the question. Nick, what about any potential charges to the source of the money of the illegal finance contribution, the Norwegian, or the real estate broker who was kind of the straw in this case?
They were treated as cooperating witnesses and were given a form of limited immunity in exchange for their sworn statements. So they were, in essence, flipped to go against the real target of the investigation, Michael Greco.
What kind of evidence did prosecutors have? And, you know, starkly, why go for the no contest plea?
They had emails between the gentleman and a couple other people showing how this plan was formulated to donate this foreign money. But it seems that the prosecutors didn't necessarily feel they had evidence that would win over a jury if this went to trial. You know, there's a little wiggle room in the emails. Mike Greco, for instance, said that he didn't know that the money that ultimately came from Tony was the same money that he had been discussing with Peter Hagland earlier, even though the donations were just a month apart. Both Hagland and Rodriguez Tejeche gave sworn statements, however, saying that Greco had directed this, knew exactly what was going on, knew exactly what the source of the money was. But I also believe the prosecutors felt maybe there'd be some credibility problems with these witnesses in open court. Hagland's a Norwegian playboy millionaire. Tejeche is a realtor, which is not always the most popular profession with everyday people in Miami-Dade.
With a jury of your peers, yeah. And what about this was a state case. As you mentioned, this wasn't after the source. This was not an accepting foreign money, which was could be a federal violation. Is there a federal investigation at all here?
Not that we're aware of. The Justice Department usually doesn't go after these kind of cases in a criminal proceeding. The FEC could get involved, but we're not aware of a federal investigation at this point.
And Joy Fletches, the next election cycle for Miami Beach is?
In 2019.
And he will be eligible, former Commissioner Greco, to run.
That's right. He has at most a year that he's on probation, and he is expected to take a ethics and campaign finance class that could actually get him off probation within 6 months.
So even sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Great work. Thanks for sharing it with all of us here at WLR. And Joy Fletcher's covering City Hall of Miami Beach for the Miami Herald. Nick Nehemas, investigative reporter for the Miami Herald as well. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Plenty more to come here on the Florida Roundup. FPL's bill to turn the lights back on after Irma, topping $1 billion. And Coral Gables is suing the power company, but not for money. That's next when the Roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for listening to WLRN. Well, the tab is almost in, $1.3 billion, the cost to reconnect FPL customers after Hurricane Irma. That may mean an extra $4 a month on your power bill this year and $5.50 per month the following year and the year after. Now, the Florida Public Service Commission still has to approve any recovery fee first before it winds up on your monthly tab. FPL customers still have another 5 months of fees to pay from Hurricane Matthew, and they're still paying the recovery from the 2004-2005 storm seasons. Before the Irma fee was announced last week, Coral Gables moved toward suing FPL, but the city doesn't want money in its lawsuit. So are you ready to pay $5 a month, maybe a little bit extra, on your electric bill to pay for the reconnections from Hurricane Irma? 800-743-WLRN. All across South Florida, toll-free at 800-743-9576. Jim Saunders is back with us, executive editor of News Service of Florida, with us from Tallahassee. Jim, tell us about what FPL is expected to ask for from its customers.
Well, you're correct. I mean, it's they said yesterday they're going to ask for $1.3 billion to recover that, starting in March and going through 2020, and the it would somewhat replace the Hurricane Matthew charges that people are paying now, although it'd be a little bit more than that.
I think Hurricane Matthew is what, like $3.50 per 1,000 kilowatts,
yeah,
something like that.
And it would go to $4. Essentially, the Matthew charges are going to drop off people's bills after February. They'll be done.
Yeah.
But they'll be replaced by these Irma bills, so people won't get a break. And they will go up a little bit. And then, as you indicated, in 2019, the charge will go up to $5.15. Now, also, you got to remember that that is sort of a that's sort of a benchmark that utilities use, but a lot of customers probably will see larger increases than that,
yeah,
because they use more power than that benchmark. It's sort of a minimum number almost.
Yeah, this is so, based upon the 1,000 kilowatt per hour usage, and not a lot
right,
of
and if you have a,
customers
if you have a bigger
can,
house.
Yeah.
Or
if it's really hot outside and the air conditions running, for instance. Yeah, all
exactly.
Those kinds of things.
You folks in South Florida run your air conditioning a lot.
We tend to have to use it, although the past 36 hours have been very pleasant here in South Florida. Nonetheless, how does this recovery, kind of cost recovery, work? Why is it, and this question comes up every storm season when we see this, why is it the customer paying for this recovery and not the shareholders of these companies, in this case, FPL's parent company, NextEra Energy?
Well, there's been a lot of precedent for this over the years. I mean, it goes back to past storms. From a most immediate legal standpoint, there was a settlement that FPL reached. It's a rate settlement last year, and baked into that settlement is says that they can recover storm costs. And it's as long as they can go into the Florida Public Service Commission and essentially prove that they spent what they spent on overtime and contracted labor and poles and all the equipment and everything else, they're going to get this money probably or pretty close to it.
Well, you mentioned the PSC, the Public Service Commission. It has to approve this or disapprove it. Does it have any – can it change the amount at all?
Well, I think the thing they will be reviewing is the actual costs. And I don't think they have a lot of discretion in terms of just saying, hey, we're going to cut 10 or 15% off the top of this. But if FPL comes in and asks to recover costs for things that are not Irma related or are very tangential to Irma, they could cut that a little bit.
Yeah.
But the way it's structured is that as long as FPL can prove its costs, they're pretty much going to get it, it looks like. And as I said, there's precedent for this in past storms as well.
In fact, they're still on the bills for FPL customers all the way going back to 2004 and 2005. Jim Saunders with us, the executive editor of News Service of Florida. Thanks so much, Jim, for your reporting on this. FPL profit in the third quarter, by the way, $566 million. It has made about $500 million each 90 days over the course of this calendar year so far. Now, before this recovery fee effort was announced Thursday during the earnings of the parent company of FPL, the city of Coral Gables had told its legal department to move forward with the lawsuit. Lance Dixon covers the City Beautiful for our partner, the Miami Herald. He's back with us here on the Roundup. Tell us a little bit about this lawsuit, Lance.
The lawsuit is, so it's not official yet,
right?
But they decided to move forward with things and directed their city attorney and their staff and their outside counsel to pursue it and have drafted a complaint. And essentially, as you kind of stated, they're not looking for any money. They're not looking for damages or anything like that. Basically, they want a judge to intervene and say, hey, we've got aging infrastructure. We've got old electric poles. FPL is saying that we haven't trimmed our trees, but in our view, the utility is responsible for those things. So we need someone to step in and essentially have FPL do these things to prevent future problems.
Mayor Raul Valdez Fowley heads up Coral Gables. He's with us on the telephone. Mr. Mayor, welcome to WLRN. Nice to talk to you. Why sue?
Thank you very much.
Why sue FPL?
We're suing FPL because there's no other way for us to sit with FPL and make him live up to the responsibilities. We have a franchise agreement with him, which obligates them to do things. And we discovered through the heroic restoration efforts that they made in order to get our lights back that our infrastructure, our transformers, are 60 years old. 60 years old. Remember the rotary phones and the princess phones and whatever? That's less than 60 years old, and that's the age of our transformers.
So are you saying that FPL is in breach of your contract with it to provide the exclusive electricity to the city?
Yes, they are in breach of their agreement. Our poles broke in half. They're supposed to be treated wood, but treated wood lasts 10 years. They broke in half with termites and with rotten wood and whatever. They haven't trimmed trees. It's their responsibility under our regulations and under state law, and state law, mm-hmm. to trim the trees in the back of their houses. They have an easement there. It's their easement, and they are authorized. We're asking Asplund, that's a private company that trims trees. We're asking to see their records of the payments to Asplund. I haven't seen an Asplund truck in 5 years. And we, in the city of Coral Gables, they blame us, but we are 13 square miles. We have 6 full-time tree trimming crews in our city. You know how many the county has? The county has 2. We have 6 to trim our trees, and they blame us for it. I think it's They're very irresponsible, and the reason for the lawsuit is there's no other way for us to get them to sit and talk with us, to pay attention
so,
to us.
So, Mayor, FPL has rejected any kind of reopening of conversation with you to for the city of Coral Gables to sit down and discuss where it thinks FPL is coming up short in relation to its contractual obligations?
They did reject it until we passed unanimously that we would sue them. And now there's a meeting set for Wednesday. As you said before, we are not looking for, or as Lance said, we're not looking for damages, we're not looking for monetary compensation, but we're looking for them to live up to their agreement.
Yeah.
We want to have stable power. I bet that there are not 10 Coral Gables residents whose lights have not flickered in the past year, 2 years. You know why? Because the transformers are 60 years old. We have over 100 pictures of broken poles and whatever it is, transformers, and yeah. We want service from them, and we're paying enough.
Does the franchise agreement stipulate that transformers of a certain age have to be replaced, or wooden poles have to be replaced with concrete poles?
No, it doesn't stipulate that, of course not, but
okay.
It does stipulate that we have to have electricity, and yeah. We have to have stable supply of power.
I'm going to bring in some phone calls here, Mr. Mayor, so stand by. But, Lance, I want to ask you again, even before the city took this action, when the restoration efforts were still underway, the city moved toward fining FPL. Tell us about that.
Sure. So in that initial week and a half or so after the storm, when everybody was still kind of trying to get their power together, get their power restored, surveying damage, things of that nature, FPL kind of put out a sort of what they at the time called a sort of hard deadline of September 17th, power will be back. Then they kind of pushed that. They kind of hedged on that. And so that drew the ire of the city of Coral Gables. And they essentially said, we're going to, through our code enforcement, issue a sort of cease and desist letter and start issuing fines for every day that power is not fully restored in our city. So that lasted for a couple of days. Those fines were more than $60,000. And that case is sort of separate from
right.
what they're doing here, pursuing this lawsuit,
right.
and they've kind of been able to mitigate that. And once power is restored, the fine stopped. But that was definitely sort of the initial kind of a kind of conflict that, that led to this.
Absolutely.
Can I jump in for a second?
Of course, Mr. Mayor. Go ahead.
Yeah, on Thursday, after the hurricane, they were blaming the lack of restoration of power to the fact that we didn't trim the trees that mm-hmm. were touching power lines. And I absolutely forbid our employees from touching those lines and touching those trees because I didn't want any electrocuted employees. It turns out that they had specialized crews that would do that, which they had not dedicated to our city. When we issued the cease and desist order, then they found it upon their goodwill to bring those crews and clear those lines and trees from, you know, trees that were touching the lines. Mm-hmm. But it took our cease and desist order and our threat of litigation in order for them to do that.
Mr. Mayor, let me ask you a little bit about the tree trimming, and we're going to get to the phone calls here in a moment, because this has been a key part, obviously, of what FPL says caused the length of time in terms of the restoration. As you mentioned, FPL is responsible for the vegetation, cutting it back, or the vegetation for the power lines. That includes private property, in your understanding?
In back of every single house in Coral Gables, there's an easement which belongs to FPNL and which gives them, and under our resolutions and state law, the 1920s, the power and the instruction to go back there and trim those trees that are touching the lines.
And has the city of Coral Gables ever discouraged FPL from doing tree trimming?
On the contrary, sir. On the contrary, we have authorized them, and you know, the Lance or I can provide you a copy of the resolutions.
But in no case has FPL contacted Coral Gables or has been cutting trees, and landscaping or Public Works has come out and says, no, let's keep these palm trees, or...
In no case.
No case.
And if you go down Granada or you go down some of the other boulevards, you will see that, you know, the V-shaped trees, mm-hmm. because they cut, you know, the trees so the lines go through them.
Yeah. Mayor Raul Valdez-Fowley, mayor of Coral Gables. I know you got to run, Mr. Mayor, so thanks for your time this Friday. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, sir.
We're
going to
continue
it.
Our conversation. Bye. And on to your phone calls. We'll begin in Hollywood, where Linda is on the telephone. Linda, thanks so much for calling the Florida Roundup. You're on the radio.
Yes. I came to Florida in 1957 to go to the University of Miami, so I've been here 70 years. 60 years, I'm sorry. At that time, Florida Power and Light was begging for customers because everything was gas in those days because of hurricanes. It seems to me that recently, the last several years, the Florida Public Service Commission has been doing more service for Florida Power and Light than they have for the public. Every time you turn around, Florida Power and Light is getting a rate increase or some sort of subsidy from the customer rather than from their shareholders. I always thought the utility investment was supposed to be a long-term, solid, good investment that you expected to make a decent dividend from. But now, as with everything else having to do with Wall Street, greed has taken over. So it seems that the customer is really footing the bill, and I'm on a fixed income, and $5 a month sometimes can make a difference between $5 worth of food on my plate and $5 to Florida Power and Light shareholders. So I really am fed up with the Public Service Commission and the way it's been treating its customers, or the customers of Florida Power and Light down here recently.
Linda, you're well-informed, a lot of great perspective there, and appreciate you sharing it with us here on the Florida Roundup. And Lance, one of those points of contention that she talks about in terms of the regulated electric business, which is the FPL business, you have to go through all the regulatory bodies if they're going to raise rates, for instance. A number of years ago, a lot of those companies began to diversify into unregulated areas, power generation and elsewhere, and the parent company of FPL, NextEra Energy, is certainly no stranger to that. You just heard Mayor Valdez-Fowley from Coral Gables. You cover the city. Is there, in your estimation, is there common ground that the city is looking for here?
I think so, because they didn't officially file the complaint because, and as he mentioned, FPL's attorney showed up at this past Tuesday's commission meeting after there had been some emails back and forth that were none too friendly and a little bit of, it seems, hesitation on the parts of the two sides to sort of meet and discuss these things.
Yeah.
So at that meeting, they essentially said, look, we'll try to set up a meeting. We'll try to mediate this, settle it out of court. But if not, then we'll proceed with the lawsuit. So most of the members of the commission didn't seem too hopeful that the talks were going to lead to anything particularly productive. Mm. But, you know, they're gonna give it a shot and go from there. But I think it's likely that the complaint and the lawsuit will go forward. A
couple of quick more phone calls here in Miami. William on line one. William, you're on the radio. Your thoughts?
Thanks for taking my call. With regards to the additional fees, that has an appearance to me somewhat as an imposed assessment. At which point is FPL responsible for the obligation as a business to maintain their own infrastructure, whereas we purchase the actual energy from them, as well as we've paid for infrastructure? And at what point then does the consumer still need to pay for infrastructure from a natural disaster?
Yep.
And why isn't it paid for together, let's say, with the government assistance, FEMA, or whatever it is that governs
the cleanup efforts. Yeah, sure.
Right.
No,
right.
I think I got the question, William, and we put that to Jim Saunders of New Service of Florida earlier, who pointed out, you know, there's a significant body of work, past precedent of these publicly regulated utilities going to the state regulatory agencies and making the case that these storm costs, the restoration from the storm costs from natural disasters, are reimbursable. And, you know, we're still, for FPL customers and pretty much anybody in the sound of our voice and on the terrestrial radio signal is an FPL customer, except for folks down in the Keys, we're all still paying for, you know, storm restoration from 2004 and 2005, even if you weren't a resident of Florida at the time.
Right. If I may, is it fair to say that shareholders then have zero risk?
I would say that the risk for shareholders is not the risk to the cost of the infrastructure, but rather the most significant risk to shareholders would be the market value risk that FPL's parent company, NextEra Energy, may be under, as opposed to the cost of the infrastructure alone. But really a great question, William. I want to stick in one more quick phone call. Speaking of the Keys, John is joining us from the Middle Keys and Marathon. John, you're on the radio. Thanks for holding on.
Thank you. I find it kind of hard to swallow, you know, the complaints about FPL during a national, you know, a disaster down here. The Florida Keys endured, and I know that's not part of FPL, but all these power companies, I mean, I have the linemen from all over this country have come down here and worked diligently trying to, you know, get the infrastructure back up. And I really find it, you know, makes me nauseated to hear people complaining, you know, that they didn't get their power back in 2 or 3 days. I mean, this is, you know, this is a real world, and, you know, there are people that still don't have power in Big Pine Key.
Yeah, certainly in your neck of the woods, John, folks did experience those Category 4 storm winds, and I probably would try to make the difference maybe between complaining about the power company and applauding the workers and the linemen, men and women who did the work. But, John, I we get you, and we understand that absolutely. We hope that the recovery is well underway in your neck of the woods and Marathon.
Have a good day.
All right, thank you so much. Lance Dixon, finally, from you, as we've mentioned, the Coral Gables has drafted the lawsuit but not filing it. Do you get a sense of what the tipping point may be, and perhaps it could come even with the meeting coming up between the city and FPL this week, and depending on the tenor of that meeting?
Right. The lawsuit mentions a breach of contract and mentions a sort of franchise agreement that was approved back in, like, I believe, in the late 90s, and it's kind of, you know, extended for a couple decades. And so, essentially, I think that what it'll come down to is what sort of obligation FPL feels it has, and if they're willing to sort of meet the city halfway on some of these things. But if not, then I think that they're going to continue their course. And the city has already considered things like the cost of undergrounding power lines. Yeah. It's been considered in some other parts of the county. North Bay Village approved about a $9.1 million bond to pursue that. But even they've said that the cost for that could be a little bit more than they anticipated. Mm. So it's something that they're looking at and trying to study, I think, carefully. But in the meantime, they're trying to see if cooler heads will prevail. But doesn't seem likely.
And I got to think a number of these municipalities with these franchise agreements with FPL are going to be watching closely Coral Gables and see how it proceeds from here.
Definitely.
Lance Dixon, covering the City Beautiful for our partner, the Miami Herald. Lance, always great to have you on the Roundup. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
The Roundup will continue in the high cost of the Wave streetcar idea in Fort Lauderdale and the difficulty of finding dollars to pay for new public transit in South Florida. That's next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for living. South Florida lives in gridlock. Population growth, tourism, sprawl, and a healthy job market all mean more people on the roads, and that means more traffic, of course. It has pushed local governments to look for solutions to get people out of their cars while still moving them around. Not transportation, but mobility. An initial bet in Fort Lauderdale is the Wave, but the streetcar project for the downtown area could cost twice as much as originally planned if it gets built at all. It's just the latest public mobility project running into the reality of limited dollars and questions about its need and whether or not the public will actually use public transit. So this is where we are at in the Florida Roundup for this program. Are you willing to pay more to get moving on a train or a bus or a streetcar or an express bus? What about higher taxes to help unclog the roads? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also look for us on social media, on Twitter, at WLRN. Katie Swatowski is along with us, WLRN's Broward County reporter. And Larry Barshevsky writes for the South Florida Sun Sentinel with us on the telephone. Katie, how much could this Wave project wind up costing?
Hi, Tom. Well, you know, the city of Fort Lauderdale has seen the expected costs sort of creep up little by little every year for the past few years. And, you know, City Mayor Jack Seiler was saying it's something that just seems to continue to grow. And the city was expecting about $195 million before bids came in. They were expecting, you know, earlier, a few years ago, $144 million. Mm-hmm. So you can see the creep, but bids came in at, you know, $80 to $100 million over what the city and county were expecting.
So close to $300 million. It was at $150 just a few years ago. Larry, what makes up for that almost doubling of cost before shovels have even gotten into the ground?
Well, we don't know. The bids are private and won't be released till after a decision is made on the awards. But I was talking to Broward Commissioner Steve Geller the other day, and he's been informed that one of the big problems that the contractors are inflating their costs for is they don't know what's going to happen when they dig into the ground to install the fixed rail system. Fort Lauderdale's an older city. City officials don't know necessarily where all the pipes are. And there's a lot of unknowns that come into play when they start going underground.
Describe this project to us, Katie. What is the Wave?
Well, it's going to be not even 3 miles long. If all goes well, it'll be about 2.8 miles of rail with overhead cables in downtown Fort Lauderdale. But it won't serve, you know, the lower income neighborhoods in northwest Fort Lauderdale. Mm-hmm. You know, the people that really need more mass transit to get to downtown. So, you know, it's a short rail project that's not supposed to upset traffic flow right now, but nobody really knows once they start building how traffic will really be affected.
Larry, is it fair to describe the Wave as an aspirational project to kind of proof of concept that rail could work in local rail could work in Broward County?
Yes, and it had another goal too. I mean, there's been tremendous growth and development in Fort Lauderdale in the downtown area between commercial and especially residential, especially in the Flagler Village area. And a lot of that was premised on the idea of this mass transit, this form of transportation materializing.
And how's it paid for? Where do the dollars come from for it?
Well, the money is split from the government. The federal government so right now the projected $195 million cost was fully paid for. The federal government kicked in about $82 million, the state another $53 million, and then the county, city, and the city's downtown development authority kicked in the other $60 million. However, any new cost probably would not be getting federal money, and the cost would have to be split between the state and the local government.
And the $60 million that was locally funded, Katie, what do we know about the source of those funds?
Well, it comes from a couple of different, you know, community redevelopment agencies. And, you know, those are questionable in terms of their loans right now.
Yeah.
So they're being paid off with high interest.
Larry, finding public dollars for public transit is not a Broward County only problem, no doubt about it. But voters, what, just a year or so ago, failed to pass two different sales tax increases, half of which, half a penny would have gone to transportation, half would have gone to local city infrastructure. The transportation passed, but the city infrastructure didn't. What does that tell us about the appetite for public dollars toward public transit?
Well, county officials are hoping the fact that the transportation portion passed is good news. The commission, the Broward Commission, is expecting to put another penny sales tax increase just for transportation on the ballot next year. Mm. They haven't made a final decision on that yet, but they have been indicating that's the way they want to go. But one of the difficult things is, even though it passed last year, there's going to be new rules next year, and instead of 50% of the vote, they're going to need to get 60% for it to pass.
Let's take your phone calls here on The Wave, public transit, mobility, and funding for it in South Florida. Russell is on the telephone from Fort Lauderdale. Russell, thanks for holding on. Your thoughts.
As Larry knows, I'm the only person who spoke out on the issue at the county commission meeting a couple weeks ago, as I'm a gadfly against Broward County. And basically, this city was not built for trolleys. San Francisco was built for trolleys. That was well over a century ago. They're an antique mode of transportation. It was not built for a fixed rail, and that's going to take away from the driving lanes. Also, as he mentions, when you dig in, and the city has crumbling clay sewer pipes and all that are leaking, and that's why all the septic tank trucks are pumping the sewage out. So once you start digging, you're going to crumble up all this stuff underground and all. And that, it serves a very limited crowd in the downtown area, and nobody's going to come out of their building just to go to Broward General or the courthouse or whatever. It has limited purpose and scope, and the costs are passed on to the taxpayers always. And I spoke out against that. So this is a pie-in-the-sky dream that has no reality. If you look at Disney World, they use tram systems, and very efficiently, to get you from the parking lots to the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't they put in the tram system that would do a similar thing that takes you on the limited routes that need to be done downtown? It could be air-conditioned and everything. It doesn't have to take a fixed rail and take away your driving ability in the downtown, which has enough problems already.
Yeah. Russell, yeah. We hear you. Yeah, against the wave. Don't think that it's viable by any stretch of the imagination.
It's like out of fantasy land. Or something.
Right. Gotcha. But instead, it's in downtown Fort Lauderdale. Larry and Katie, if it were to be built, is there a public fare to this? Do people pay to use it, Katie?
Yes, definitely. And it's interesting you say that, because the county mayor, Barbara Sharif, was talking to me a little bit about, you know, what she thinks of the bids. And basically, she was saying if the true costs are reflected in these four bids, and, you know, it's going to end up costing close to $300 million to build, there's no way a fare could be kept low enough to serve people that would ride it.
Yeah. And Larry, as all public transit officials, I think across the country, certainly South Florida, will say the fare box collection doesn't make up for the maintenance and operating costs by any stretch of the imagination. What do you know about ops and maintenance costs for something? If it's $300 million to build it, what's it going to cost to run it?
That's right. The county knows it's not, the county is in charge. It has agreed to operate and maintain the system once it's built, and they know that they're not going to be able to collect enough fares to cover what they're estimating to be about $6 million a year once it's in operation.
How much?
About $6 million a year.
$6 million. Okay. Yeah. For under 3 miles. Of operation.
And the thing is, I think Russell had raised an interesting point that leaves a lot of people scratching their heads. The trolley will run, the streetcar will run in the same lane of traffic as other vehicles.
Yeah.
So it's going to be stopping at red lights just like all the other traffic. So that's raised some concerns among people who think this really isn't going to be a faster way to get around. A
couple of quick comments from our ground source text audience. Chris from Hollywood probably won't ride it. Not due to its limited service area. Being such a limited service area, I don't see its purpose. Jessica in Fort Lauderdale, I don't know that I would walk between my house and any stop in the heat we experience here with all the sunshine and humidity. Katie Swoltowski covering Broward County for us here at WLRN, and Larry Barshefsky writing for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Thanks to both of you for joining
us
today on the Roundup. Finally, this week on the Roundup, a look at WLRN's newest film documentary, Boca Raton, the secret weapon that won World War II. Back in the early 1940s, Boca, it was certainly a sleepy seasonal town, but it played a crucial role in the Allies winning the war.
When the Army Air Corps came down to look for sites, they saw this airport. They saw the ocean, the wide-open ocean. They saw the wide-open area. They saw how isolated it was. And so they decided this might be the place. What they were planning to do in Boca Raton was top secret. They wanted nobody to know what was going on here. And in fact, nobody did.
Historian and author Sally Ling in the new documentary film Boca Raton, The Secret Weapon That Won World War II, a new documentary film from us here at WLRN and WLRN Television, premiering November 6th at 8 o'clock on WLRN Television, November 6th. You can see a trailer on our website, by the way, at WLRN.org. That's the Roundup for this week, produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre, WLRN's program director, Peter Mertz, and our technical supervisor, Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening.